Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine welcomes Dr. Benjamin Judson. Dr. Judson's an assistant professor of surgery and an active member of the Yale Cancer Center Head and Neck Cancer Program. Here's Francine Foss.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to Yale?
Absolutely. So I'm a head and neck surgeon, and I specialize in taking care of patients with any neck tumors. So any tumor, either benign or malignant, that's anywhere between the brain and the lungs. I did my residency at Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and then I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York for the last 2.5 years, and just came to Yale in January of this year.
So, Ben, what are the different areas included in cancers of the head and neck? You mentioned the neck, but can you go through the different areas that you would cover?
Absolutely. There involves really any tumor in the neck, and it's a quite diverse area. So patients can develop tumors in the mouth or the tongue, the tonsils, the throat, the voice box. We also see patients with tumors that arise in the saliva glands. So there's a parotid submandibular and sublingual glands. We see patients with advanced skin cancers if there's a question of whether it's spread to the lymph nodes in the neck or it involves any deeper structures. We see thyroid cancer patients and also patients who have tumors that arise in the sinuses or the skull base. So it's quite a diverse group of patients with a diverse set of problems.
And Ben, are most of these patients referred to you by primary care doctors or oncologists? And how do you get them?
All different ways. Sometimes people just walk in to see us, but most frequently, as you pointed out, we see patients who are referred to us by their primary care doctor or a dentist, an oral surgeon, a medical oncologist. Usually people see someone else first, and then they get sent on to see us.
So this might be a good time for us to let the audience know how common head and neck cancer is.
So there are just under 50,000 cases a year of new patients in the United States with some sort of head and neck cancer.
And that includes cancers of the thyroid and the sinuses as well. That includes all the different types of head and neck cancer?
Well, so that number is mostly patients with a head and neck cancer that's a squamous cell cancer that arises somewhere in the mouth or as I mentioned, the tongue, the tonsil, the throat. And that's the majority of the patients that we see.
So what are the risk factors for head and neck cancer?
That's a great question. Classically, the risk factors have been smoking and drinking. So patients, we know that patients who smoke have a slightly increased chance of developing a head and neck cancer. And that's also true for patients who drink. And there seems to be a synergistic effect. So patients with a long smoking history and a long alcohol use history are the patients who have the highest, are at highest risk. But we do see all kinds of patients, even patients who don't have those risk factors, come to us. Interestingly, in the last 10 years or so, as the smoking rates have decreased, we expected to see a decrease in the number of patients like this, like we've seen in lung cancer. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened. There's actually been an increase in patients with tonsil and tongue-based cancer, both here in the United States and abroad. And there's been some really interesting science done to figure out why that is. And it's implicated the human papillomavirus, or HPV virus, which has been known to be involved in cervical cancer, also turns out to be able to cause tonsil and tongue-based cancers.
So, Ben, how does one acquire this HPV virus?
It's an excellent question as well that we don't completely understand. There are certain high-risk types of HPV, and, having some sort of HPV infection is very common. The majority of Americans have had one at some point that's then cleared. But there definitely are risk factors that are related to sexual activity. So people who are sexually active and have a higher number of sexual partners over their lifetime are at higher risk for obtaining one of these high-risk HPV infections that put you at, you know, a risk for developing a cancer like this.
And so just for the sake of our audience, if there are folks out there who know that they've got HPV infections, say, in the cervix, yeah. Are those people at high risk for head and neck cancer, or is it a separate set of risk factors?
It's connected. So patients who have had high-risk HPV infection in the cervix, those patients and also their sexual partners are at slightly increased risk for developing an infection with one of these high-risk HPV types in the oral cavity as well.
So as a parent, and I'm sure that there are other parents out there who are thinking the same thing, more kids now are smoking and drinking earlier. Are you seeing more head and neck cancers in younger people as a result of this?
Well, so we are. You know, classically, we would see patients would present to us with a history of heavy smoking and drinking, usually in their 60s and their 70s. And what's happening is we're seeing more and more patients in their younger patients who are never smokers, never drinkers, who have HPV-related cancers. And the peak age of those patients when they come to us are in their 40s. So it's really a very different patient population for us. It's sort of a, you know, it's a changing. We say that the face of head and neck cancer is changing. And, you know, we still see all the patients that we used to see, but we're also seeing this new subset of patients you know, who don't have the classic risk factors. And, you know, we haven't known what's causing this until relatively recently when HPV infection has been implicated.
So how do most patients present? Do they present with lesions in their mouth or swellings? Or what is the typical thing?
Yeah. Patients with head and neck cancer frequently have symptoms that are very common, you know, symptoms that we all have at some point. So they'll have a sore throat, a sore, you know, an earache, a problem swallowing, swollen lymph glands in the neck or a lump in the neck. You know, but those problems usually, you know, those symptoms when most of us have them go away. They're related to a cold or an infection, and they usually go away after a week or two. You know, if they stick around for 3 to 4 weeks or longer, that's somewhat concerning and worth having it checked out. And that's usually how patients present.
So a lot of patients must also present to dentists because a lot of people think if they've got a sore in their mouth, perhaps the dentist is the first place to start.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a good way to start. I mean, if there's a question and there's something that you can see, seeing a dentist or an oral surgeon or an ear, nose, and throat doctor, or your primary care doctor is a great way to start because they're usually able to, you know, make an initial evaluation, and if you need to be referred to someone else, they're able to do that.
In fact, I think having just had my annual dental appointment, I know that the dentists nowadays do a very careful head and neck check. They put on gloves and they really feel all of these glands and these nodes that you're talking about. And that's now part of routine screening for most folks going to a dentist.
Yes, the American Dental Association has made a big push to do that because we know, as with other cancers, if we detect these things early, people do much better. And so just like people are doing, other screening modalities have been used, colonoscopy and mammogram, increasingly the dental community has recognized that it's really important to do a careful examination to try to find these things early so that patients can have them taken care of before they're, you know, more involved.
So, Ben, once a patient has identified a lesion that's suspicious or there's a lymph node or sore throat that hasn't gone away, what's the next step? How do you actually make a diagnosis of head and neck cancer?
Diagnosing these things really starts by a physician or a dentist doing a careful history, talking to the patient, examining the patient very closely. Those are sort of the cornerstones. If there's something there that's suspicious, the next step is usually doing some sort of biopsy. You know, sometimes based on what we see and feel, you know, we need to get some imaging or radiographic studies to help us as well.
What kind of studies do you typically get? We've talked a lot about CAT scans and PET scans on this program. You know, what's the right imaging study?
Yeah, the imaging study that's done first is generally a CAT scan of the neck to actually look at the tumor itself and also to evaluate the lymph nodes in the neck, which is where these cancers can go first. Another scan which can be very useful is a PET scan.
And when you see these tumors in the head and neck, you've made a diagnosis based on a biopsy, I presume. Do you have to worry about these spreading to other parts of the body?
Yes. Generally, that's always a concern, and that's an important part of our evaluation and affects the treatments that we give. The tumors can spread usually first to the lymph nodes in the neck, and then there's also a chance that these can spread elsewhere in the body.
So when you get your scans, initially you're getting your CAT scan of the head and neck. Then do you get a scan, in most patients, do you get a scan of the rest of the body as well, or is that only in certain circumstances?
In certain circumstances, we routinely get a chest X-ray. Generally, if cancer is not spread to lymph nodes in the neck, there's a very low likelihood that it's gone elsewhere in the body. Once it's gone to the neck, then there's a little more concern to look elsewhere, and that's frequently where we'll get maybe a CT scan of the chest or a PET scan or something like that.
And Ben, are there specific blood tests that would be enlightening for patients with head and neck cancer? Are there blood tests, say, that would predict for who's going to develop metastatic disease? Or are there blood tests that could even be used as screening for head and neck cancer?
There's not. It's a fantastic question, and there's a lot of research in that area. But there are no good blood tests for tumor markers to help identify patients who have a cancer or to monitor their progression afterwards. The one exception to that is that there's a cancer that can arise behind the nose called nasopharyngeal cancer, and a subset of those cancers have been related to Epstein-Barr virus. This is a cancer that's relatively uncommon in the United States, but it's endemic in China and other parts of the world. And because nasopharyngeal cancers are associated with Epstein-Barr virus infection, it's been shown that you can do a blood test for Epstein-Barr virus markers, and that's useful in diagnosing these patients, predicting their prognosis, and also helping follow their response to treatment.
A lot of folks out there have heard of Epstein-Barr virus with respect to mononucleosis, and I just want to make our listeners a little bit comfortable about the fact that this isn't very common
right.
in that setting.
That's
just
correct.
Because you have Epstein-Barr virus, you don't need to worry necessarily about nasopharyngeal cancer.
Yeah, thank you. As I said, this is a very rare, uncommonly seen, relatively rare problem here.
And Ben, you talked about nasopharyngeal as being a type of head and neck cancer. Are there other subtypes?
There are. So we classify cancer in terms of its anatomic location, so whether it occurs in the oral cavity, that's sort of the front part of the mouth, and then behind that is the tonsils and the base of the tongue. We refer to that as the oropharynx. Below that is the larynx, sort of the voice box area.
Great. So we've heard a little bit about some of the demographics of head and neck cancer, and when we come back after the Medical Minute, I'd like to talk a little bit about the treatment of this disease.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. As a matter of fact, 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. The good news is that major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm here with Dr. Benjamin Judson, Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology at the Department of Surgery at the Yale Cancer Center. And we're here tonight discussing the treatment of head and neck cancers. So we talked a little bit about the types of head and neck cancer. Let's launch into a discussion now about how you treat this disease.
Thanks, Francine. The treatment varies a lot on the type of tumor and the extent of the tumor. The one thing that I would say is that it's important to design and tailor a treatment to an individual patient and the individual problem that they have. So one of the reasons why I came to Yale was to join the excellent multidisciplinary team that's already here. And it's, you know, so I work with a medical oncologist and a radiation oncologist, as well as others, with each patient trying to tailor a treatment that's, you know, individualized to them.
So, Ben, we talk a lot about multidisciplinary care, and I can't think of any area where that's more important than head and neck cancer.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the treatment options are for patients?
Absolutely. So for earlier tumors, we try to use a single treatment. Sometimes that can be surgery. Sometimes that can be radiation. And it just depends on where the tumor is and the patient.
So, Ben, can I just back up for a second? Unlike other cancers where we don't cure many patients, is your primary goal for most of these patients to actually cure them with your therapy?
Yes, frequently, especially for early stage cancer, but for anyone, as long as it hasn't spread beyond the neck, our intention is generally to cure the cancer.
And so that's important when you think about long-term side effects of your therapy.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why it's so important to come up with a carefully tailored treatment approach, because we're trying to balance our getting the best outcome we can in terms of treating the disease, but also minimizing the side effects that the patient experiences immediately after treatment and long term.
So do all patients have a surgical excision of their tumor?
Not at all. It just depends on what type of cancer it is, its size, its extent. For the early stage, we try to do a single treatment, so either surgery or radiation. For more extensive cancers, we generally combine a treatment, so it can be radiation with chemotherapy, or sometimes surgery followed by radiation. And then for more advanced cancers, frequently we'll combine all three. So it'll be surgery with radiation and chemotherapy together.
So there are some novel ways now of giving radiation therapy. Can you go through that a little bit and tell us what's available at the Yale Cancer Center?
Absolutely. So in the past, historically, radiation to the head and neck has been administered in a way that it treats or, you know, affects the entire neck and throat. But now there are incredibly sophisticated ways to target the radiation, so it's given just to the areas that are needed, so just to the tumor and the areas around there, maybe the lymph nodes in the neck. And the reason why this is important for patients is that the radiation can cause lots of side effects like dry mouth or problems swallowing. It can affect the jawbone and cause problems with the jawbone weakening and even breaking with the old-style radiation that was given. Now, those side effects are really minimized, and we rarely see that because the radiation is targeted just to the area where it's needed.
And that's called IMRT?
That's one important technique for doing it, for giving radiation in that targeted way, yeah.
Okay, we talk about radiosurgery in other kinds of cancers. Does that apply to head and neck cancer as well?
Not routinely, but there are situations where we use it in this situation in this case as well.
There also are some novel surgical techniques that are being pioneered here at the Yale Cancer Center in terms of minimally invasive surgery. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So techniques using endoscopes to remove tumors through the mouth so that we avoid an external incision were really pioneered in Germany, but they're beginning to catch on here in the United States. And so we've been doing that here at Yale for the last several years. Often we use a laser as part of that technique to remove these tumors without making any external incisions. And an interesting recent event in our field is that the FDA recently approved the use of the robot to operate through the mouth as well. And so we're planning to begin doing that here at Yale within the next year.
That sounds kind of space age. Can you talk a little bit about how that robot does the operation?
Sure. Oftentimes these tumors, are small, but if they're in the back of the throat or down in the throat, they're very hard to get to. And so in the past, in order to remove the tumor with a nice cuff of normal tissue around it so we feel comfortable that the whole thing is out and the patient's going to, you know, not going to have any problems. It's required making, you know, bigger incisions in the neck to get there. The robot allows us to go through the mouth and actually have great visualization, and then we can perform very sophisticated surgeries just through the mouth using the robot.
It sounds like that's a tremendous advance for patients in terms of side effects and long-term sequelae from these kinds of operations.
Yes. It's not for everyone, but for those patients where it can be done, it can make a big difference.
Let's talk a little bit about chemotherapy now. Do all patients require chemotherapy?
No. You know, as I mentioned, it really we try to tailor the use of our different types of treatment to the patient's needs. And, you know, so sometimes chemotherapy is used in conjunction with radiation alone as a single, treatment for a patient. And then also in patients with even more advanced cancer, sometimes we combine surgery with radiation with chemotherapy that's given at the same time as the radiation.
And I know that you work closely with your colleagues in medical oncology to treat patients with chemotherapy.
That's correct.
And there are some drugs that actually sensitize to the effect of the radiation.
That's correct.
And I think that's been a major step forward in some of these bulkier tumors.
Yeah, that's correct.
Can you talk about the head and neck program here at Yale?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, there's a great head and neck team that's already here that I've been really excited to join. We have an event scheduled in April. It's a free head and neck screening event. It'll be at Smilo Cancer Hospital on April 16th from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. And listeners who are interested can go to www.yaleheadandneck.org to find out more details and register.
Great. Can we talk a little bit then about patients who have already been through this, patients who've had their surgery, their chemotherapy, their radiation therapy? How long does it take people to recover from this disease?
It varies a lot. And for smaller tumors, patients sometimes will have surgery in their home the next day. If we also involve some neck surgery, it's usually a couple days in the hospital. And then for the larger tumors, people can be in the hospital for 1 to 2 weeks. And in those patients, you know, the healing process is one that can take weeks to months as we, you know, work with them to restore their swallowing and their speaking function.
So during that period of time when they're recovering, do patients require, say, TPN or some other way of nutrition because they can't eat normally?
Yeah, that can happen. If that's the case, if it's going to be more than a week or two, we generally try to use a feeding tube in the stomach to allow them to use their gut, which is still working, for nutritional support.
And I know that when you radiate the mouth that you can sometimes lose the salivary gland function. How difficult is that for patients?
That can be quite difficult, and that's one of the reasons why the IMRT, or the more targeted radiation therapy, has been such a breakthrough for these patients, because you'd think that having a dry mouth doesn't sound so bad, but it actually can be quite bothersome. And with the more targeted therapy that we're using now, it's much less common.
And there are other supportive care medications that can be used in that setting as well to stimulate saliva?
There are. And one of the things that's important for those patients is that they take very good care of their teeth, because saliva has an important protective function in terms of protecting the teeth. So it's important that they're followed closely by their dentists, and the dentists work with us to make sure that they don't have any dental problems.
Ben, can you talk a little bit about the future for head and neck cancers? Are there new advances coming down the pike that we should know about?
Yes. There are advances in all the areas that are used to treat head and neck cancer. So as I mentioned, there are increasingly minimally invasive surgical approaches so that patients have less side effects from the surgery. There are new chemotherapeutic agents in development and that have been developed in the recent past, which help in these patients. And, you know, there continues to be improvement in the radiation technology that's used to treat these patients. And, you know, as with some other treating other cancers, really the most important thing, I think, is to work as a team, have a team approach and to tailor a treatment for each person.
Are there biological therapies, say like monoclonal antibody therapies, that are available?
Yes, one of the chemotherapeutic agents is a antibody that targets EGFR that is relatively well tolerated compared to some of the other chemotherapeutic agents, and that we use, you know, routinely.
And also, are there specific therapies now for the HPV virus? Are there ways that we perhaps could prevent head and neck cancer in people that carry the HPV virus?
Well, it's a great question. One of the things that we're beginning to learn, and some of the research has been done here at Yale, is that patients with HPV-related cancers have a better prognosis than tumors related to smoking and drinking. But how to tailor a treatment based on that is still an area of intense research. You know, we don't want to de-intensify our treatment because we're doing pretty well in those patients. But I think that that's where one of the futures is in terms of an area of research, trying to basically tailor a treatment based on the risk status that a patient has.
So we now have these HPV vaccines that young women are getting
Yes.
to prevent cervical cancer.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't know yet whether those are going to prevent head and neck cancers.
Yes. So there's no evidence to show that they're useful in treating head and neck cancer, but they do, you know, the two types that both the vaccines that are commercially available prevent our HPV, include HPV type 16 and 18. And those two are the types that are also implicated in head and neck cancer. So there's every reason to believe that the vaccine will protect against, if someone's, you know, as long as they protect against those types of HPV infections, that they'll also protect against the associated head and neck cancer that they can cause.
Great. So that's something really for us to look forward to in the future.
Absolutely.
So, Ben, I just wanted to ask a few other questions because we now are looking more at the federal level at issues of disparities in terms of cancer incidence and cancer care.
Yeah.
And we didn't touch on this at the beginning of the program, but could you just talk a little bit about the frequency of head and neck cancers in different racial groups and whether the disease is worse, say, in one group versus another?
It's an area of intense investigation, and there has been some studies which showed, for example, that African Americans with oropharyngeal cancer were not doing as well as the rest of the population. What has come out more recently is that may be driven by HPV infection. So it may be that more of the African American population don't have HPV-related cancers, which may explain why they're not doing as well.
So that leads us, I guess, to the whole issue of screening, which we talked about, and perhaps people in certain disparities groups ought to be screened more frequently.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we've had a very, very good discussion here tonight about head and neck cancer, and I'd like to thank you for coming and being my guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Benjamin Judson, who is Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology at the Department of Surgery at the Yale Cancer Center. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, and have a pleasant evening.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.